Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to The Longest Night. We are a Game of Thrones and House of the Dragon show on the Podbreed network, and we work with our friends over at the Narth subreddit as well. My name is Rob, and I have seen every single episode of Game of Thrones at least half a dozen times, and I have read Fire and Blood by George R.R. Martin.
My name is Lizzie. I've also seen every single episode of Game of Thrones, but I haven't read Fire and Blood by George R.R. Martin.
And I'm Jay. I've seen every single episode of Game of Thrones. I have read Fire and Blood by George R.R. Martin, and I've also read all five books in the Song of Ice and Fire series to date.
Yeah. So that's the lowdown on who we are. If you want to, you can come and find us over on Twitter. We are at LongestNightGOT. That is at LongestNightGOT. And our title music was written and provided by Edward Thomas. You can find all of his available work in the description. Not to date the episode too much, but I guess Lizzie and Jay, we've both seen the news about Miguel Sapochnik's future plans in the sense that they do not involve House of the Dragon.
Yeah.
Bit of a shame, but you know, if this first season's finale is the last episode of Miguel Sapochnik's that we get, then we can say thanks very much to Miguel for all of his work in the Song of Ice and Fire and Game of Thrones and House of the Dragon universe,
Yeah. All
the stuff that he's done. All right then, let's get going into this week's episode. This week we are going to be discussing Season 1, Episode 2 of House of the Dragon, entitled The Rogue Prince. It was written by showrunner Ryan J. Condal and directed by Greg Yatanis. It was first broadcast on the 28th of August 2022 to an audience of 10.2 million people, which is a 2% increase, roughly, on the figures for the first episode, which was a big surprise.
Yeah.
I seriously thought the figures were gonna go down.
Yeah, me too.
Up they go.
Does that happen much for TV shows? Rarely. I feel like whenever you see the charts, it always goes down after the first one, right?
Particularly for a new show, it's usually like you're lucky if you get half the audience come back.
Mm. So, general thoughts about the episode. We'll do what we always do, throw to Lizzie first. Lizzie, how are we feeling about The Rogue Prince?
It's a good episode. I did find it a little bit more difficult to follow than the premiere, just because it seems to have like a bit more of a loose time frame in terms of the events that go on. And so, you know, without reading your notes, I wouldn't have really known that like 6 months passed between, you know, the last episode and this one and things like that. But overall, yeah, I thought it was really well done. I'm still very much into the direction they're going with this, you know, with that the family that's kind of falling apart at the seams. But I'm aware I'm rambling, but I did like this episode. Not as much as the last one, but overall, still a thumbs up.
Hmm. Yeah, Jay, what about you?
Yeah, I think it was really good. It wasn't as good as the last one, I agree, but not in like a bad way, just in the way of there was just a lot more kind of heightened drama and tension and stuff in the last one. Whereas this is not a bad thing. It's actually a really good thing for me because I like it when things are a bit more talky. I enjoyed, just seeing characters discuss things and have things be laid out and themes discussed. And yeah, I liked it. So it wasn't as like, you know, jam-packed with stuff as the previous one, but there was a lot there to enjoy.
Hmm. Yeah, I've got to agree with the two of you in that I don't like it as much as last week, but I still like it rather a lot. I think it's another kind of setup episode, but it's really solid, and I think just like last week in the second half, there were two or three real standout moments and real standout scenes. And there's something I kept picking up on throughout the episode, and I'm trying to work out why. Maybe I'll figure it out as I discuss it over the next sort of hour or so. Which is that I'm trying to work out why this episode seems to be focusing on, like, festering wounds and rotting flesh. Like, you open up with the crabs eating that guy. And then you have the maggots eating Viserys' finger, and you've got Alicent scratching at the skin around her thumbnails, and lots of really grisly images that are going to live with me for a while. I keep thinking about just those, like you know, when you've been in the bath too long and your hands go a bit wrinkly, or a swimming pool. But, like, that taken to, like, the nth degree with the very first shot of the episode, where that guy's hands have just kind of withered away because of how much water damage they've suffered. And even just from that first moment, it's like, oh, very grisly. I think House of the Dragon is taking a bit longer than Game of Thrones did to find its feet when it comes to those kind of two-hander, talky scenes. I think the, what was it, people talking in rooms was the phrase that was used while Game of Thrones was on. I think a lot of people just assumed that Game of Thrones had such great, snappy dialogue because, oh, like, you know, Benioff and Weiss are just copying the books, and so of course it would be good. But clearly, Benioff and Weiss knew how to write, shoot, and edit all those scenes so that they had, like, a proper bite to them. In that just in that first season, all those ones that they had to add in later on because the episodes were coming up short. And even when they went past the books as well, just in my opinion. But House of the Dragons, they're small council scenes, for instance. They're good, but they can feel a bit stilted in comparison to Game of Thrones. And I'm sure that'll change with time. I think it's just trying to find its feet, trying to find its voice. It's a very different kind of story. And I'm getting a bit sick of the complaints that I'm seeing. I'm not sick of seeing complaints. It's just the type of complaints I'm seeing about, why isn't there a character like Davos in this who's really funny? Or the Hound who's really funny? And I'm just thinking, like, in the first season of Game of Thrones, A, we didn't know Davos. And when he was introduced, he wasn't a fun character. He's only really, he only really becomes light relief when he's under Jon's command. And we're supposed to actively dislike the Hound until about midway through season two. And I think people are confusing their long-held affections for the characters in Game of Thrones. For a show that's 9 days old. And so, as much as I'm comparing it to Game of Thrones in terms of how certain scenes feel, I'm sure that it's just something that will change as it goes on. House of the Dragon will find its own voice and its own feeling. And I think something that you said there, Jay, about the strength of the themes that get discussed in this episode, as much as the dialogue isn't as snappy and doesn't bite me as much as Game of Thrones did, Game of Thrones is, like, my favourite television show ever. So, like, I still think the stuff in House of the Dragon is still really good. It's just in comparison to the parent show. And I think that an example of House of the Dragon being really good with its dialogue still is that I think that the themes are there and there's things to interrogate and it's trying to explore things. And I'd much rather have a show that tries to explore things through serviceable, solid dialogue than to have a show that focuses so much on the minutiae of the sentences that are being spoken that nothing really comes out of them. And I think this episode ends up being about, like, the order of things, who buys into it, why they buy into it, who tries to break the order of things. And there's a lot of stuff to chew on in the aftermath of this episode. I think lots of characters responding very differently and like individuals to the circumstances that are played out in front of them.
Yeah, definitely. And I think also with comparisons, like, I mean, I'm all, you know, I'm all for comparing stuff that's close together, but at the same time, you know, you're comparing something that has been around in people's lives and in pop culture and on TV for a decade. Like, it wasn't just a thing that happened that you watched once that, oh my god, it was really good and iconic and I remember all these snappy lines. It's like, this is something that people watched again and again and memed into oblivion. And, you know, it takes time for lines to appear. It takes time for characters to become so memorable and things. Like, you're comparing that to something that's, it's not even out 2 weeks. Like, you've got to give it a chance.
We'll be right back. In part one of the episode, in The Stepstones, a Prince Admiral of the Triarchy, known as the Crab Feeder, executes shipwreck pirates and soldiers, nailing them to posts on the beach so that they can either be eaten alive by crabs or drowned by the rising tide. And later in the episode, we are shown that the Crab Feeder apparently has grayscale. I was wondering about this when I saw his skin, and apparently it was confirmed by Ryan Condal in some kind of exclusive to HBO Max behind the scenes stuff that got shared on social media. But apparently, yeah. But before we get into the actual episode, we found out what the theme tune was going to be for House of the Dragon.
We did.
And it turns out it's the Game of Thrones theme tune. So... yeah, Lizzie, how did you feel about that when it first started playing?
I wasn't surprised. If anything, I was slightly disappointed, just because, not because I'm like, oh, we should have got a different theme. It's more like I actually liked that truncated intro from episode one, because I feel like that sort of thing gives the show more room to breathe. And this show obviously needs a lot of space because it's massive. Whereas with that long intro, I just feel like I'm going to skip it on future episodes.
I understand why they've done it, because they clearly, now that the show is actually underway, a lot of the marketing from before the show feels like, I mean, I feel like I was justified in ignoring it, because the amount of talk that was going on about how, like, it's going to be something different to Game of Thrones. Like, we promised that George R. R. Martin's really heavily involved this time, you guys. And, like, we're trying to be something different. And, like, you know, the Game of Thrones gave us this, and now House of the Dragon's going to give us that. And I was like, I think I'm just going to ignore this. Because, like, they're trying to sell the show to people who were disappointed by the end of Game of Thrones and don't want Benioff and Weiss's fingers near any of it. And they want George R. R. Martin's hands all over it and stuff. So, you know, they were just trying to, you know, sell it to people, and that's fine, because often when somebody's trying to sell a product to somebody, they say things that they don't mean. Often they are asked to think on the spot in press junket interviews, and it's like the seventh interview they've done that day. So I tried to ignore all that, and I think I'm justified, because ever since the show's actually come out, Ryan Condal has been very open about the fact that he's like, I'm trying to connect the two shows in little ways, and it feels like this is how they're going to do it. And we were saying last week how, like, the Game of Thrones theme tune is so iconic that trying to do it again with something else would be difficult. And last week they just avoided the issue completely. And this week they've now avoided the issue for the rest of the show. It's just like, oh, well, we'll just use the Game of Thrones theme. But, like, I can understand why people would be a bit disappointed, because I'm really growing attached to the prince that was promised, which was the music that played over the end of episode one with that piano motif that's like doo, 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 or something like that. And I thought that could be worked into the theme somehow, but nope, it seems that they're just going to pay homage to Game of Thrones. Jay, what about you?
For me, I'm a little bit disappointed that it's the same music, because, you know, something new would be nice, that'd be fine. But I'm kind of okay with it. For me, the most disappointing thing is, and this is weird, is the actual, like, it's the animation, it's what's on the screen while the intro's playing. Because I get it, right? It's doing the Targaryen history and stuff, but, like, it's kind of a bit muddy and a bit difficult to really grasp. And it's the thing about the original one, I've always had a bit of a theory that the part of the reason why the music has become so iconic, not just that it's a really good piece, which it is, but, like, that intro, like, you're learning things. There's, like, people don't skip the intro, sure, because the music's good, but also because you kind of need to follow it, because it's showing you so much information that it's kind of difficult to get otherwise. It's a very sprawling show. And you're being shown all these locations, and then you see a new location in episode 8, and you're like, ooh, we're going somewhere new, oh my god, and it's so far away, oh my god. And in this, it's just kind of like, it's just stuff happening. It's just like, just animation happening. Yeah, it's just animation happening in front of you. And it's like, okay.
I'm glad you mentioned muddy as well, because I found the whole thing very, like, brown and grey.
Yeah.
Whereas in Game of Thrones, like, obviously you have Beyond the Wall, and it's like bright white. You've got King's Landing, and it's all red and gold. You know, you go back to Winterfell, and it's like the the light blue and the green tree. It's all that different. It's the differentiation between those locations.
Yeah.
Whereas with this, it just felt like a bit of a mulch.
Yeah, I'm not disagreeing, actually. It looks nice. I kind of see what they're doing. I like the sound effects with the blood kind of like trickling down, and the fact that, like, you know, like doors and dams in the flow of the river of blood kind of get unlocked as it goes along, and it's like a puzzle piece that fits itself together. But it's fine. I just feel like they have attempted to avoid the issue of trying to live up to the Game of Thrones theme, and I think that's ended up being a bit of a double-edged sword. But hey, you know, it just means I can ignore what's going on screen and just kind of listen to the music, which is a great piece, which they seem to have chopped up slightly. They've shortened it by a few bars here and there just to kind of fit it into the animation. But anyway, just this little prologue showing what's going on with Crabfeeder. Do either of you have any notes about this guy and his torture methods and whatnot?
I've got a little bit.
Yeah, cool. Go ahead.
I mean, I definitely didn't need like another reason to be creeped out by crabs. And I also wonder if George R. R. Martin has a thing about crabs, because I don't know if either of you played Elden Ring.
Yes, I have.
Yeah, because isn't one of the enemies a giant crab? And he was a consultant on that game.
Yeah.
I think they're like... I can't remember. Yeah, I think so. I think you're right. I know there's lobsters, and I think there might be crabs as well.
Yeah. But anyway, like, aside from that, it's rare that the... Like, even Game of Thrones, it's rare that it ever kind of lurched into horror territory. And I think it's the difference between the quick, usually somewhat painful, but, you know, it's pretty much over in an instant deaths that you get in most of Game of Thrones, and like the slow, painful deaths where it's just like you don't know when it's ever going to end, and you're just trapped in this nightmare that kind of pushes it into that much darker territory, I think. I found it really interesting. It came as a bit of a shock, because I wasn't expecting anything like this to be introduced in the show, and definitely not so early. Like, I didn't know anything about it, but I thought this would be more like based in that family drama that we got in the first episode.
This method of torture and the images and stuff, this may be one of my favorite fictional methods of torture, like in terms of how evil the guy must be, because like you nail this guy to a post on a beach.
Yeah.
And then it's either you get eaten alive by crabs, and if you don't get eaten alive by crabs, you drown. And it's like there's no way out. It's like rock and a hard place, but either way, it's going to hurt and you're going to die. And it's like, whoa, like some sickos come up with this. And like, yeah, and I think it does a pretty good job of setting up this crab feeder guy as like, you know, a pretty... you know, a bit one-dimensional, but, you know, someone who needs to be taken care of. And I love how they're expanding the crab feeder into, like, a bigger character in the show as well, because his involvement in the books just kind of goes by. And it's also at a slightly different time as well. They've moved the crab feeder stuff and all the stuff in the Stepstones, they've moved it forward by about 6 or 7 years. They've moved it back by about 6 or 7 years so that it coincides with everything that happened last week. Whereas everything with the crab feeder kind of takes place about 6 years before Queen Emma's death in the book. And so, like, they've moved it up, and so it has stronger emotional consequences for the characters that are actually involved in the House of the Dragon story, which I really like. I think it's a great adaptive change. I also think that establishing shot, after the grisly shot of the guy's hands and the guy getting eaten by the crab and stuff, they cut out to that wide establishing shot, and you see all of the crab feeder's various minions. And apart from a couple right at the bottom of the screen, they're all walking from side to side.
Oh, really?
And so you sort of have to look for a second and go, wait, are they like massive crabs? Oh, no, they're soldiers. Right, okay, that's fine. And which I thought was a good touch, if only because it confused me for a second.
The thing about moving things around is something that I think we won't go into detail on in this, but this is an episode that contains a lot of that, I think. When we get into some of the later events, you're seeing a lot of things being moved around. And generally for the better, because it is kind of like, it's arranging things in a way to make, to serve individual character stories better. And to make certain moments land better. Obviously, the big one that we've already discussed is, you know, the friendship between the two central girls. But yeah, there's a lot of them that comes up in this episode. It's quite a weird thing for Game of Thrones to open on, but it's a tonal shift that I quite liked.
The Valyrian capital was built into a volcano, much like Dragonstone. And the Dragon Lords, the highest of the nobility, lived here, at the volcanic face, closest to the source of their magic and power. And this was the Anogrion, where the Blood Mages worked their craft.
It is truly wondrous what you've built.
Oh, I only pore over the histories and provide the plans. The stonemasons built the structures.
Do you believe that Westeros can be another Valyria, Your Grace?
That depends whether you speak of the Freehold at its height or at its fall. Over 1,000 dragons, a navy large enough to span the seas of the world, the glory of old Valyria will never be seen again.
In part two, in King's Landing, 6 months on from the events of the previous episode, Corlys Velaryon informs King Viserys that 4 ships have recently been sunk by the Crabfeeder's armies. However, the small council advises King Viserys against taking action so as to avoid all-out war with the Free Cities. It is also mentioned that Daemon Targaryen has captured the seat of Dragonstone with a loyal army. After Rhaenyra speaks out of turn at the small council meeting, she is asked to choose a new Kingsguard member. She picks Sir Criston Cole, and later on in the day, she prays with Alicent. After he talks with Alicent in his chambers, Viserys then meets with Corlys and Rhaenys. Corlys apologises for his behaviour in the small council, but reminds the king that he must remarry soon. Corlys offers up his 12-year-old daughter, Laena, as a potential match. Jay, the small council meeting, how do we feel about that?
First of all, I liked the idea of her, kind of interrupting and being like, hang on, I have an idea now. And it's kind of like, well, yeah, you just named her heir. what else are you going to have? I like the entire it goes on to be the entire scene of her, like, kind of observing the knights. And seeing them all, I enjoyed that, and I do enjoy Sir Criston Cole. I think that casting is going to turn out to be really good. I also like, you obviously mentioned Bacallus saying that it's quite fun. I think a lot of people might have missed in the first episode. It's one of the first things that happens in the episode is him talking about the crab feeder and the triarchy.
Yeah, complaining.
I feel like there's a lot of people. Well, there you go. I think there's a lot of people who probably just won't have adjusted their ear yet to listen to those kind of things. And we'll go back and watch the first episode and go, oh God, he was complaining about that in the first episode, and they're still not doing anything about it. So I quite like that kind of rewatch bonus of letting you know that no, Corlys is a very switched on person, and he is he's not to be messed with, and he knows what he's talking about, and he kind of potentially is starting to feel like he's the only sane one in a council of fools.
Yeah, as I think it's good to see, while we're on him, it's good to see Corlys being used more in this episode, because I felt like he was in the episode last week, but we didn't really mention him because he's not really that involved. But I think, like you say, moving the Stepstones conflict to this point in the timeline means that we get a side plot now that, like, involves Corlys's, like, grievance at not being taken seriously at the small council, and obviously that has ramifications at the end of the episode, and it provides a different motivation for Corlys to choose to do the things that he does in the story, especially with the end of the episode. Just while we're talking about Corlys Velaryon, I just want to give a brief shout out to Linda Antonsen, and to sort of say that Corlys Velaryon and his whole family are black, and there's nothing that you can do about it. So, yeah, there you go. Shout out to Linda. Hope she's listening wherever the fuck she is. back to our normal episode. Lizzie, what did we make of Corlys's complaints in this episode?
I like how Jay, you just said that Corlys was the most sane one in the small council when he's literally offering up his 12-year-old daughter to his boss.
I know. Outside of the council, he's those just are the levels we're talking.
Yeah, I mean, I think we briefly touched on like the small council in the intro part, and just like how this feels like there's something missing there. I think it's maybe that aside from Corlys, Otto, and Viserys, it feels a bit anonymous. Whereas when I think of Game of Thrones, I think of the small council. I think of all those individual personalities and how much they kind of clash with each other. You know, let's say the classic small council would be Varys, Littlefinger, Cersei, I guess.
Yeah, Joffrey, Tywin. Yeah.
And, oh, what's his name?
Pycelle,
thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, and how they all have those, like, their individual quirks and clashes. And I think, like, aside from those three, I struggle to name any of them.
Yeah, they haven't really been fully introduced yet. Mm. There's a couple of faces that you'll come to sort of remember and recognise as the show goes along.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think the nature of the time jumps kind of means that we're not spending time, we're not seeing the members of the, other than Otto and Corlys and Viserys, we're not spending time with the members of the small council away from the small council yet.
Yeah.
I imagine, depending on where they go with the show, I imagine that will happen more and more as the show kind of grows. But I think this is kind of the point I was making at the beginning where, yeah, the characters and the scenes that they're involved in at the small council, they do feel a little less engaging than Game of Thrones did, because it doesn't yet feel like it's clearly approaching its characters very differently. I think you can definitely tell Daemon, Rhaenyra, Otto, Viserys and Alicent apart, and I think they're really working hard on those five because they're the centre of the story right now.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And then you have Corlys that's kind of like, and Rhaenys who are kind of like the extra leg, if you will, but the characters that are outside of that, the ensemble hasn't quite had the focus yet, and I totally agree with what you're saying there. I will say though that the exposition in this episode is a bit more graceful. It's not as forced, and I do think that they're handling it a bit better, and I think that if the exposition is handled a bit better this week compared to last week, then hopefully the character details will be handled better going forward. It's like they're taking care of one thing at a time, just improving it as it goes along. Jay, I just want to go back to what you said about about how good it is, a decision they've made to have Rhaenyra choose Ser Criston for the Kingsguard rather than Viserys. Because A, it happens on screen. B, it's a bit of it's something that Viserys does in order to placate Rhaenyra, make her feel important without her actually being given too much power. But she feels like she's been given she literally steps up. You know, she literally stands on that little stool to look over and stuff. And so I love that. But also, as you can tell, Ser Criston's being built up to be a bigger character down the line. And watching the decisions get made is exactly what I hoped would come out of House of the Dragon, which is these things that just sort of get mentioned on the page, like, King Viserys brought Ser Criston Cole into the Kingsguard, and it's like now we can actually see the admin and the planning and the the thoughts that went into it, and it provides some good emotional context, I think, for where that storyline eventually goes.
It's true, and I think there's a bunch of character not development necessarily, but just kind of explaining characters through actions in that scene where you have like Rhaenyra, who said, "I want to make this pick," but then she's there, and the symbolism of her, like, you know, leaning up to try and like be a bit more taller, but also, you know, she's quite boisterous and stuff, but then still has to kind of like be told by Otto to like make sure you remember your graces and stuff. Mm-hmm. I thought there was lots of like little bits in that scene that kind of, it's fleshing things out. It's development. Ser Criston obviously, yeah, is going to become a big part of it, and seeing that relationship kind of become a thing, and also, as you say, yeah, the fact that it's her decision makes it even more of a real thing for us.
Lizzie, I'm wondering how you reacted to Corlys's suggestion that Viserys marry his 12-year-old child.
It should shock me, but it doesn't.
Yeah. You've been in Westeros far too long, Lizzie.
Yeah, I mean, it actually shocked me more later on, but we'll come to that.
Okay, then. The other thing I just want to mention, the giant sculpture's there again.
Yes. There's a lot of little, and we'll see if we get more as we go along, but for book people, we're getting some unexpected, for me anyway, little tiny little hints to, like, the ultra backstory history of, like, old Valyria and stuff, which I wasn't quite expecting to get in this, but we're getting, like, weird new bits of information. Which is...
Do you mean just about, like, what caused the doom and, like, how they lived and...
Yeah, exactly. And I'm wondering if we're going to get more of that as we go along.
I think digging into a volcano in order to put your city within it to stay close to the magic...
Might be a red flag.
The only thing I think about when he was saying that was fire coming out of the monkey's head. You know, track 13 on Demon Days, where it's like pretty on Gorilla's Demon Days, and soon they began to mine the mountain. And it's like this whole society that digs further and further and further into a mountain, and then it explodes and everyone dies. And it's a bit like, yeah, well done, lads. You know.
I know, right? I thought it's just a Balrog, isn't it? I liked it as well, the symbolism of, it's kind of on the nose, but I kind of liked it for how on the nose it was, of Viserys dropping and breaking a dragon, and Alicent picking it up and going and fixing it, given the revelation at the end of the episode.
I just want to make a correction from last week, by the way. The designer's name, I mentioned that it was Beth Phillips, it's actually Beth Roberts. I was quietly reminded of that by a lovely person on social media, thank you very much.
Oh, nice.
Just on the Viserys dropping the dragon, I keep thinking about why Viserys is building this model, or at least having stonemasons build it. And I think there's a big clue when he says to Alicent, like, he wonders whether Westeros can ever really compete with Valyria or replace it for the Targaryens. Like, maybe he's beginning to question why they came over, whether he's capable of holding the weight of House Targaryen on his shoulders. Like, you know, we came over because Aegon said, oh, there's this dream of a threat from the north or whatever, and it's like, well, now we're here, and it's like, is the threat ever going to arrive, and like, are we just marking time, and, you know, we were once so powerful, could we not do something else with our time in Westeros? But it's clearly, you know, the Iron Throne started to reject him at the end of last week, and now this, and you just sort of get the feeling where it's like, is he fit, really?
Yeah.
To be king.
Yeah.
You just sort of start wondering. Lizzie, do you have any notes about the rest of the first half of this episode? About the maggots eating his finger.
Yeah, I don't really. But again, it adds to this sense that, you know, it's like, it's not just, is he fit? Is he even, like, what's holding him together? Like, we had the cut last week, and... you know, this week, it's sort of like you're falling apart, like, literally and figuratively.
Mm.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I think for me, the big model is just kind of, the whole thing is about him worrying about an heir, right? Because of his line and the lineage and all the rest of it. And for me, it's just kind of the thing of, like, oh, I pore over the histories and stuff, because he's kind of subconsciously worried that it might end with him if he doesn't succeed.
The Dragon Keepers believe she made home somewhere on the coast of the Narrow Sea.
The workers at Spice Town report hearing her song at times. They say it is a sad thing.
I imagine even dragons get lonely.
Your Grace, it would be a great honour to join our houses as they were in old Valyria. I would give you many children of pure Valyrian blood so that we might strengthen the royal line and the realm.
Is that what your father told you to say? What did your mother tell you?
That I wouldn't have to bed you until I turned 14.
In part 3, Viserys is awkwardly introduced to Laena for the first time as Rhaenyra and Rhaenys watch from a nearby balcony. Rhaenys bluntly tells Rhaenyra that she will be replaced as Viserys' heir if he marries and his wife gives birth to a son, telling her that men would sooner put the realm to the torch than see a woman ascend the Iron Throne. As Viserys dines with Alicent, who has repaired a model of a dragon that he broke earlier in the episode, Otto Hightower calls an emergency meeting of the small council. Viserys is told that Daemon has stolen a dragon's egg and taken it to Dragonstone. Viserys is then given a letter, which is a wedding invitation from Daemon. He says that he is to marry Missaria, who is pregnant with his child, and intends to put the dragon egg in the infant's crib when it is born. In response, Otto heads to Dragonstone. So, Lizzie, it didn't shock you, but how did you feel about that scene when the fruits of Corlys's labour came to bear, and Laena was there chatting with Viserys? How did that go down?
Yeah, it's really straddling that line between sweet and sickly. Like, Laena is obviously very cute. You know, they're like, what did your mother tell you, like, that I wouldn't have to bed to you until I turned 14? Like, it's so clear that you've had these lines sort of fed into you, but also horrific that you're having to act this way around the fucking king.
Yeah.
And it's just like, yeah, this is normal in King's Landing. And, you know, obviously we've seen things like incest before, but this is kind of taking it to another level. I think I wanted to talk more about Rhaenys, actually. She's great in this episode.
Yeah.
Like, constantly sort of peering over and sort of seeing the webs spin themselves and everything kind of spin out of control. And all the while, she's just sat there thinking, well, you know, it could have been different. So all you needed to do, just one thing, just say my name and this could all be gone. But no.
I think Rhaenys is the clue to the heart of this episode about the order of things and whether people kind of go along with it or don't go along with it. And because obviously the Laena scene is really horrible, but you can sort of see how little girls like her grow up to be women like Rhaenys under Westeros's patriarchy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Rhaenys knows that what's happening is immoral and scary, but she's kind of been, over time, not exactly beaten into submission, but it's more that, like, she sees the order of things, knows that the order of things is wrong, but just sort of goes, well, there's nothing I can do about it. Like, you know, she's all very kind of smug and self-satisfied about the fact that, like, she can't change anything because nobody will let her change anything because there was a chance for her to change anything and she was passed over.
Mm-hmm.
She can try to work in compromises, like saying that Laena won't have to bed the king until she's 14, but ultimately she does kind of accept the order of history because, as we explored last week, that's just what she's been raised to do.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, it's like that the women are just kind of pawns in this game that's going on. And, like, I just want to bring this up. I really don't like the AV Club's coverage of House of the Dragon. It's so disappointing. Because, I mean, I know that the AV Club got gutted about 2 or 3 years ago and loads of good writers left. And, like, I was thinking, like, in 2011, they set up, like, a newbies and experts section for Game of Thrones, where it was like they had someone who was totally new to Game of Thrones but loved TV reviewing the episodes. Mm-hmm. And then they had a book expert reviewing the episodes. And it was a great thing to, like, you know, to read both sides as the show went along. Whereas this time it's just what clearly looks like a text-to-speech recap with a grade slapped on it. And by someone who, I'm not going to call the writer out directly, but, like, just doesn't seem to be engaging with the show at all and not really understanding it either. I think the person who's writing the AV Club's reviews is misunderstanding something that I thought was simple, which is that depiction does not equal endorsement.
Yeah.
And they seem to have a fundamental misunderstanding of stuff like that, and they're reviewing one of the biggest shows in the world for one of the most popular TV reviewing websites. But a morsel that I have managed to get out of that recap on the AV Club is that they've said that the show should be called Game of Dads instead of House of the Dragon. And this scene definitely gets to the heart of that, which is like, there's a little bit of 4D chess going on between Otto, Corlys and Viserys and Rhaenyra, Alicent and now Laena, who has been thrust into this horrible web of just ugly and horrible age gap relationships and stuff like that. And
yeah,
it's now we have two dads pimping out their daughters, one mm-hmm. quietly and one openly, so that they can just secure that extra bit of power for themselves. And Otto has been the cleverer of the two, I think, because he's manipulated Viserys by being patient. You know, 6 months have gone by while Alicent has just been slowly visiting Viserys and getting to know him, and that's Otto securing his power, as we see at the end of the episode, whereas Corlys is like, I want you to marry my daughter. And Viserys is like, he immediately notices, like, with Alicent, it's kind of like the frog in the cold water that's slowly being boiled. Whereas with Corlys's methods, it's like they've dropped the frog into the boiling water, and it's like Viserys is immediately like, oh my god, she's younger than my daughter, what the hell is going on? Whereas with Alicent, it's like...
Yeah, it's Alicent, least, it's my daughter's friend, you know.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's Otto's daughter. She's, I'm just treating her like a my own daughter or a niece or something like that. Yeah, that's what I'm doing. Mm. Oh god, she's helped me fix that dragon. Oh, she's pieced it back together. Oh, isn't that nice of her? And I do have to remarry, don't I? And you know, and I guess there's nobody else available, and you know, and it's just, and you know, it's not exactly frowned upon. You know, she is in Westerosi lore or whatever, if there even is a lore about this stuff. It's like, she is of age, I suppose, and so maybe I could. And I think Otto takes advantage of Viserys's uncertainty about a lot of things by just kind of leaving something in front of him and then reducing his options.
Hey, and... Viserys, look at this wheel. Shouldn't it be turning?
But I do think that Viserys obviously has like a comedy. It's kind of played for kind of not like broad laughs, but it's played. He's feeling uncomfortable.
And it's awkward to humor, yeah.
Yeah, and we as the audience are feeling uncomfortable as well. And I think if you're being cynical, you could potentially go, well, that's kind of a bit on the nose, because like children were married off in the real world at this age. Like, that is a real thing that happened, and having
still
the character
happens
be
now.
Still happens now,
but yeah. Like, it, you know, it very. Having a character be that uncomfortable maybe could seem a little bit on the nose, but I feel like it's to get us used, or maybe even impress upon us, the horror of the idea that, like, we didn't really get in Game of Thrones very much, because I think Game of Thrones has so many perspectives, and it's old people and children and teenagers and middle-aged people. You have the whole spectrum of different people, and when horrible things happen to people, and they do, you're still kind of seeing it from their perspective. Whereas in this, the perspective is a very high level, and it's kind of like the horror of, wow, no, these people are using their children, as you say, chess pieces. And that's kind of horrific. So I'm kind of okay with it being kind of a little bit more comedic and awkward, because it kind of helps you kind of swallow that pill of, like, this is a really, really horrible situation that we're not used to seeing, usually, for people just kind of moving children around like that.
Mm.
Also, for book people, Laena asking lots of questions in this scene. She asks a lot of questions.
A lot of questions about Vhagar.
A lot of questions about Vhagar. But yeah, it's cool, and I totally agree about Rhaenys as well. Like, Rhaenys is just fantastic, and the conversation she has with Rhaenyra as well is just, yeah, it's laying out bare the kind of thesis of what the show is going to try and explore, but in a way that's kind of like makes sense for her character, which I liked a lot.
I love that they put Rhaenyra at a literal vantage point for this conversation.
I know,
so
right?
That she can observe what's going on and think, I don't want to get involved in this. I'm going to create a new order when I'm queen. And Rhaenys is like, yes, child. Just going to pat you on the head there. Yes, exactly. Because that is the order of things.
things.
Lady Missaria is to be my wife.
This is an abomination. With every breath you soil your name, your house, and your brother's reign.
Our love does not know titles and traditions.
And what of you, men of the City Watch, aiding the prince in his treason?
The king made me their commander. They are loyal to me. You've come for the egg. Here it is.
Are you mad? You'd never survive this.
Well, happily, neither would you.
To choose violence here is to declare war against your king.
Wonderful.
Even if it ends in the death of your unborn child and its mother.
In part 4 at Dragonstone, Otto arrives to face Daemon. After a tense standoff, Rhaenyra suddenly arrives on Syrax. She tells Daemon that he must kill her if he is to become the king's heir once again. Daemon realizes that he cannot bring himself to kill his niece and begrudgingly returns the dragon's egg to her. Rhaenyra gives the dragon's egg to Otto and his men, and the party return to King's Landing. After that showdown, Missaria reveals that she is not, in fact, pregnant, and that Daemon had concocted the whole scheme simply to spite his brother. There is no wedding planned either. Missaria remarks that while Daemon enjoys the protection of being the king's brother, his antics may endanger her life in the future. Just before Otto goes to Dragonstone, there's that really tragic line where he notices Alicent's thumbs and just says, "Why do you destroy yourself?" And it's like, no level of actual concern for his daughter's safety. It's just, stop it. Go and see the king.
Look in a mirror, dude. It's you. Like,
yeah. Exactly. He's blind to the things that he's doing. He plays the game so well that he's become lost in it. Jay, what do we make of the action at Dragonstone? I think it's probably the tensest bit of the episode, I'd say.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's our first like kind of semi dragon face off, which is fun to see. I saw a thing somewhere, probably online somewhere, of someone saying like it was. They didn't buy this whole thing because, oh, it seems so stupid that Otto would, like, go and put himself in that situation. It seemed really, like, unrealistic and stuff. And I think it seemed really clear to me that he wasn't actually trying to get into a fight. To me, it seems really clear that he's trying to provoke Daemon into doing something stupid, which seems like a pretty easy thing to be able to do. He doesn't really... never really thought that he'd ever actually... like set his men on Daemon's men at any point. He just wants Daemon to say something stupid or to do something stupid that he can go back and report to say, look, this is the horrible thing that's happening. I liked the all the tension in this, Matt Smith. I got a bit of whiplash in this episode because like a couple of hours before we watched it, me and my girlfriend watched like 4 episodes of Matt Smith's Doctor Who era, so it was kind of whiplashy for me, but I do think he's just relishing playing this like just slimy, snarky character, which is just, it's a lot of fun to watch. And I also enjoyed the Rhaenyra has a really good line after she dismounts from the dragon where she says something along the lines of like, take care not to startle her, she's very protective of me, which I was like, ah, okay, cool. Trying to impress upon us that dragons are scary, yo. They are violent and scary, so be wary of them. And also I really liked the when you're seeing them talk in Valyrium, when they're kind of talking about the whole egg thing and this is my castle, not until you've come of age, blah blah blah, and he starts talking about, you know, my son. I've loved the shots of Missaria as she's kind of dawning on her, like, hang on, I am massively out of the loop here. He's been telling all kinds of lies. And again, it's just adding that extra bit of tension of like, you think Daemon's in control, but he's telling so many lies that it's probably going to spiral out of his control soon.
Lizzie, how was it to be back at Dragonstone?
Very strange, because this show like already feels much smaller, and it makes like the... you know, the scenes before with Laena feel so much more horrifying because it's like no way out. But then you kind of see, you know, there is another side, as distant as it seems. you know, it's strange to kind of revisit that, but it's you know, it's welcome to have Dragonstone back. With this kind of standoff, it felt a bit like, I don't know how best to explain it, but it's like keeping your enemies close, but also not trying to interrupt your enemy when he's making a mistake.
Yeah.
I totally agree with you, Jane, that he's not trying to goad him into doing something, but it's just sort of keeping him in his place, because then you're, like, let's say Otto would be better placed to take advantage of it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if he knows he's going to keep doing these foolish, outlandish displays, then, you know, why wouldn't you let him to an extent, but also you don't want him stealing, like, dragon's eggs, because that's just going to spiral out of control. So it's that, how would you describe it? Like, controlled control. I know that's not a thing, but it's...
controlled, not exactly controlled chaos, but...
Kind of, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Controlled control. That's great.
Yeah. But yeah, it was a really... Like, I agree, it was the most tense scene of the whole episode. And, yeah, looking forward to seeing more of that, because I'm sure we inevitably will, like... Damon's not just going to go back and be like, oh, okay, then. All right, see you in a bit. I shall retire with my wife, who is not my wife.
Yeah. it was so good to go back to Dragonstone. When they really expanded the island in season 7 of Game of Thrones, it became like one of my favourite locations in the whole show. All the fields and the rock faces and the big castle and everything like that. It felt so good to be back in that place. I love the morning fog as well that covers it this time. Because whenever we went to Dragonstone, it was like, you know, it was always kind of clear. It was a bit windy and, you know, that sort of thing. But this, it's like, it's kind of still and there's this eerie mist that kind of hangs over the whole tense standoff. I think this episode follows a similar pattern to the premiere in that the first half is, you know, it's good. Does all the necessary bits and pieces, and then the second half moves the story into like really interesting places, and you get this cool standoff. My favourite line of the exchange is Otto Hightower swearing for the first time, which is the "sheath the fucking steel," just to sort of be like, you know, let's keep it calm. Love the little grace notes, like Daemon tossing the dragon egg back to Rhaenyra. Like you said, Jay, the viewer being clued in. It's just the fact that Missaria clearly didn't know about Daemon's plan. And I love any conversation in High Valyrian. I'm less enthused about Missaria's accent. Did anybody else find this a bit weird?
Yeah, there's a certain rhythm that I'm kind of like not struggling with. It's not that I struggle to get what's coming across. It's just, I don't know, the actress has a certain rhythm to the way she speaks that kind of makes it, I don't know, it's kind of a bit slower than maybe it should be. And so I'm kind of like waiting for the next word. It just seems like it's like, oh, come on, finish the sentence. I'm not quite sure how to describe it.
I can't say I really noticed it.
I'm kind of hoping that she does the opposite of what Aidan Gillen did with Littlefinger's accent, where he made it more cartoonish over the course of the show, and I'm hoping that she makes it less so. I think it needs to be something a bit more neutral and believable. I'm not really sure why everyone involved seems to be happy with it, because I just thought she sounded a bit like...
Sounds stilted at parts.
Yes, a little bit choppy. It just kind of reminded me a little bit of Frances... what's her name? Frances... The woman who played Madame Maxine in The Goblet of Fire. Her French accent. Frances de la Tour. De la Tour, that's her name. Yeah, her accent in the fourth Harry Potter film is not great, and it just kind of reminded me of that. And it's a shame, because Missaria is an interesting character, and I think she raises a good point that, like, it's something that we haven't... Again, it's something else that we don't really get to see in the books, which is Missaria sort of being like with Daemon, listen, you can do all these shows, you know, jokes for Otto and Viserys and stuff just to piss people off and get a rise out of them, but... nobody gives a crap about me. Like, I'm not a legitimate Westerosi woman or anything like that. I'm just, as Otto describes her, I'm just a whore. You know, they'll just kill me and be done with it.
Yeah.
Like, it's you whose name is protecting him and not me. And so, yeah, don't play in the street with my life.
I wasn't aware you had a king for a brother.
We're both men who have had to cut our own way through the world. We've been passed over too often.
Did you call me to Driftmark to remind me of my low standing, Lord Corlys? Or was there some other reason?
You've heard of the troubles in the Stepstones.
Some Mirish prince is feeding Westerosi sailors to the crabs.
I have been petitioning the king to send my navy into the territory, but he's denied me.
It was never my brother's strongest trait.
What?
Being king.
In part 5, in King's Landing and also in Driftmark, upon her return to King's Landing, Rhaenyra is basically told off by Viserys for putting herself in danger by going to Dragonstone, but they eventually discuss their shared grief over Emma, and Rhaenyra begins to understand that Viserys is obligated to marry and that he doesn't mean to upset her or offend her by trying to pick an ex-wife. However, at the small council the next day, Viserys declares that he is to marry Alicent Hightower. Otto is, of course, pleased with the decision, but Rhaenyra is heartbroken and Corlys Velaryon is furious. He storms out of the meeting and returns to Driftmark, where he invites Daemon to speak with him. The pair discuss their respective annoyances with Viserys and decide to take matters into their own hands regarding the crab feeder. So, Lizzie, how are we in this final bit of the episode?
Yeah, poor Rhaenyra. Like, it's so clear that I think she'd kind of almost got used to the idea that, you know, maybe I will be the heir, and maybe, you know, things will work out as, you know, perhaps I expected them to from the beginning. And it's not just going to be in this case of, oh no, he'll just remarry and they'll spit out another baby and that's that. Off you go, fuckity bye. It's like, no, there is a chance that something could come of this, even if I'm not the most receptive to the idea and I still have my obvious doubts about it. But I think it's the dual shock of, like, one, he's going to remarry, and two, he's going to remarry my best friend.
Yeah.
And it's like a complete betrayal. And, like, how do you even look your father in the eye after you know that? And you've lost twice in one go. It's a jab from both sides. And, yeah, I can't imagine what it must feel like to be in that situation. And they do portray it well, but obviously I don't think we've seen the full extent of the reaction. I guess we'll have to wait until next week for that. Meanwhile, with Corlys, you almost get the sense that this has happened before, even though I don't think it has, because I'm sure he's only got one daughter, or at least that I know of. But I don't know if it's just the fact that he feels he's not really been listened to for, you know, the course of the last couple of episodes. And it's just another in an ongoing series of Viserys just kind of ignoring his concerns, if you will. And, this is just the kind of, it's his last straw, the straw that broke the camel's back, if you will, that this is what causes him to leave for pastures new.
Yeah. This, I guess I can talk a little bit more about this now.
Okay.
Because we've actually come to this point of the episode, which is where I think you saying there that Viserys' decision to marry Alicent is the straw that broke the camel's back in regards to how Corlys Velaryon feels spurned by King Viserys and ignored. This is where moving the Triarchy stuff up a bit and putting it in this period of Westerosi history, as opposed to about a decade before, is that, yeah, it becomes another thing that just ticks Corlys Velaryon off that little bit more, and it fleshes him out as a character, and it's someone who is not necessarily, it's not impulsive, but he's determined, and he can get quite rattled, and And so it provides the motivation for what Daemon and Corlys do next, because the events in the Stepstones, like I say, they take place in the books about 8 or 9 years before anything happens with Queen Emma or Alicent or anything like that. And so putting those two things together, it provides good motivation for Corlys and Daemon to like join forces and become allies, necessary allies, and it means that we have that really gripping conversation at the end, which I think is one of... There's three scenes in this episode that really, really stand out to me. There's the... four, actually, because there's the stuff with Alicent and Viserys around the sculpture. There's the standoff at Dragonstone. There's the conversation between Viserys and Rhaenyra that eventually becomes about Emma, and Rhaenyra reaches an understanding about what Viserys has got to do. And this final scene of the episode where the music starts to rise up, and even Daemon sort of joining this alliance keeps Corlys at arm's length by just sort of saying, like, listen, I'm allowed to slag him off because he's my brother. You keep your mouth shut. Like, and there's just little bits of tension that are in this alliance as well. And having it all pay off at the same time as Rhaenyra being devastated over the decision of her father to pick Alicent as a wife. It hammers home that making them the same age was a really good point. It hammers home that moving the Stepstones up to this part of history was a good decision. And it really benefits the show, I think. I don't know about you, Jay, what your thoughts on it are.
Yeah, I'm completely agreed. It's... Yeah, otherwise you're just going to be kind of like having random events kind of happen, which when you're writing a, you know, a imaginary history book, makes perfect sense, because that's history. History isn't, you know, written into nice narratives. But when you want a nice narrative, yeah, move some stuff around. I think it bodes well for the future of the show. I think that it's not afraid to kind of, we're sticking to the canon, but we're just making it a bit neater and a bit more streamlined. Which is really good. And yeah, I do like that conversation of kind of the power play between them, of Corlys being like, you know, I'm really, really powerful and everything, but Daemon's like, cool, but I'm still in charge. It just kind of makes me excited for what's going to kind of come out of that pairing in the next few episodes, in terms of if we're going to see any like actual action. Not that I'm saying I necessarily think that'll be good or bad, just... Yeah, I feel like maybe they'll be building up to a bit more of that. I also think that, yeah, the Rhaenyra Alicent thing is kind of... It hits especially hard after all the scenes leading up to it earlier in the episode, but especially the one where they're praying together, or where Alicent convinces her to pray, which is kind of an important step in her trying to acknowledge her grief, and she breaks down crying. Like, you watch that scene and then watch this scene right afterwards, it's like, woof, that's painful. Although I do think that I did laugh a little bit during it, because I do think the staging of the scene is a little bit, it reminds me of, I don't remember which season of Game of Thrones it is, but the in inverted commas trial of Littlefinger, where you have like the line
seven,
of,
isn't it?
Is that season seven, where it's like the Sansa goes off on a big thing, like pretending that she's talking to Arya, and then like like how do you answer these charges, Lord Baelish? And I always laughed because I was like, what did she say to everyone else in the room? Did she like tell all of the Northern lords, like, by the way, I'm gonna pretend for dramatic effect that I'm talking to my sister, but actually I'm talking about Baelish, so when she goes and kills him, don't like freak out or anything. And it was a little
it's
bit
like
of
a surprise party or something. He's
yeah, exactly.
Come in, right?
Exactly.
You've gotta keep it secret, otherwise it's not gonna work.
Exactly. Yeah. And there's a bit of that in this where it's like. Oh, I wonder who you're going to choose to marry you. Is it the young girl who's never in any of the small council meetings because she has no reason to be here? Like, who in the room knew and had to, like, keep tight lips so that the drama could hit extra hard? It made me good. It's not flaw or anything. It just kind of made me chuckle a little bit. It's the convenience of having everyone in the same room, I guess.
I think the decision to show Viserys deciding to marry Alicent is a great idea, because we watch him grapple with it throughout the episode. We see the circumstances that drive him to his decision, and it's still immoral and difficult, but while the audience doesn't agree with it, we have been given enough material and evidence to at least sympathise, at least, like, you know, we acknowledge that you know, the Westerosi patriarchy is a system that perpetuates itself, and Viserys is not brave enough to be the one who stands in its way.
Yeah.
And so we just sort of go, oh God, this is horrible, isn't it? But we don't necessarily... I'm not angry with Viserys in the way that I'm... It's kind of like last week, where he makes a very difficult and ultimately, you know, fatal and bad decision about what happens with Emma's labour and stuff like that. But then it's the decision to just sort of, like, not tell her. It's like, I'd rather not say and have her die terrified than tell her and make her upset for a second before she dies. And and it's also the same with this, where it's like he hasn't decided to tell Rhaenyra in private. He's decided to show the public, like, I must do this the courtly, proper way. And it's just a good way, like, well, it's basically just a perfect way to see how pissed off two people are with him. Because Corlys storms out of the meeting and Rhaenyra is immediately upset. But this is where making him the same age really hammers home the point that Alicent is young enough to be Viserys' daughter, and Rhaenyra is clearly upset that she might be overlooked for heir in the future, but she's also just disgusted and she feels betrayed that, like, her best friend and father, she must feel like they've conspired behind her back in some way. And, like, that's obviously not true, but, like, because Alicent is, like, still scratching away at her thumbs in that scene because she knows what's coming, and obviously she feels guilty and she's hurt Rhaenyra simply by existing in Viserys' company. And I think this is what it all comes down to, this idea of active and passive participants in the order of things.
Yeah.
And it's Otto that's been the active participant, whereas Viserys has been more of a passive one, but they're both causing harm. And I think those who actively contribute to the order of things and those who just kind of passively accept it and don't do anything to change it, like the people who know the system and keep pushing it, are taking advantage of the people who know the system and are just kind of like, oh, I don't really know what to do. And I find it also tragic, and obviously it's upsetting as well, because it's not Alicent's fault, but Alicent will be the one that kind of gets it in the neck. Like, you know, it's from Rhaenyra. It's like, you know, I guess that's, again, how the patriarchy becomes self-perpetuating, which is that this is ultimately Viserys' decision that's been manipulated by Otto, but it's Alicent that's going to get the criticism and the grief from Rhaenyra for being like, how could you do this to me? And so,
that's something she has no say in,
Yeah. Lizzie, carry on.
Like you say, it's like neither... Well, Viserys, I guess, does have some say, and I think Rhaenyra will possibly think, how could you be such a coward to kowtow to Otto Hightower, who is, you know, lower in the totem pole? It's like, in any of these systems, like you say, there's active and passive participants, but if you think of it like a wheel, and some of the people are actively pushing the wheel, let's say like Otto, some of the people, like Viserys, are spokes on the wheel, but then you've got the people who are underneath it getting crushed, like Alicent and like Rhaenyra. And it's just, you know, there has to be someone to at least attempt to break that motion. And that in this situation, it should have been Viserys. It seems like cowardice almost. And like you mentioned, you know, last week with Emma as well, not telling her what was happening and just sort of letting it happen.
All right, Lizzie, I want your line of the episode.
Okay, my line of the episode is from Rhaenys, who says, "Here is the hard truth, which no one else has the heart to tell you. Men would sooner put the realm to the torch than see a woman ascend the Iron Throne."
Awesome. All right, then, who's your loser?
It could very easily be a three-way tie, this, between, you know, the men of the small council, but let's go with Otto Hightower.
Okay, yeah, I can definitely see why.
Yeah.
And your winner this week?
My winner of the week is Rhaenys.
Yeah, someone who observes from the sidelines and just sort of goes, well, 15 years ago you had a chance to avoid all this.
Yeah. Honourable mention to Rhaenyra, of course.
Yes. Yeah, it's kind of like last week again, where it's like all the problems in this episode would be answered very swiftly if one of them just sort of turned around and went, oh, why don't we just put a queen on the throne? That'd be fun. Should we try that? You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Give someone else a go. All right, then. Not all of us are going to be back next week. Jay, you're going to be missing next week, aren't you? You're going to the theatre.
Yes,
what are you going to go and see?
I'm going to see Much Ado About Nothing.
Oh.
Ooh.
Ah.
I'm very excited about it because it's my favourite. My second favourite Shakespeare.
Ah, what's your favourite Shakespeare?
Macbeth.
Ah, of course.
I think my favourite Shakespeare is the best of Shakespeare.
any Alan Partridge fans listening in? No, just those three? Okay. But me and Lizzie will be back for season one, episode three, which is entitled Second of His Name. And that's going to be out next week. So we will see you next time. Thank you very much for listening, everyone. Bye-bye.
See ya.
Bye-bye.